The headlines: Iran's leader says the nation has turned sanctions into opportunities for big progress, a clear example of which has already happened in the arms industry. Ebrahim Raisi arrives in Sri Lanka on a first visit by an Iranian president to the South Asian country in 16 years. And also in our headlines, Israel's indiscriminate airstrikes and artillery fire kill more civilians in Gaza as the death toll nears 34,200. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour: the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the sanctions imposed on the country were primarily aimed at putting the Islamic Republic into trouble and making it follow colonial and arrogant lines. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, however, said that the Iranian nation, with their zeal and long Islamic tradition, made such attempts futile and did not submit to such coercion. The leader hailed Iran's self-improvement to defeat the enemy's sanction ploy, saying a living nation creates an opportunity for itself to counter the enemy's hostility. Ayatollah Khamenei noted that the pressure helped Iranians make great progress, such as in the arms sector. He reiterated that the sanctions will not destroy the Iranian nation's resolve because it's not looking for help from outside. Ayatollah Khamenei made the remarks while addressing workers who had gathered from all over the country in Tehran on the occasion of Labor Week. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has arrived in Sri Lanka, marking a significant diplomatic moment between the two nations. Raisi was welcomed by Sri Lankan officials upon arrival at the Matala Airport in Hambantota. From there, he was escorted to a nearby town to inaugurate the Umauya Multipurpose Development Project, the project that includes two dams and a 120-megawatt power plant has been built by Iranian contractors. The Iranian president is due in the capital, Colombo, where he will officially be welcomed by his Sri Lankan counterpart, Ranil Wickremesinghe. A highlight of Raisi's visit is the signing of several memorandums of understanding aimed at bolstering bilateral relations. His day-long trip is in response to a special invitation extended by Wickremesinghe, and it's the first Iranian president in 16 years. Fatima Masumi is joining us now in our studio here in Tehran to offer us some more insight on the recent Iranian president's trip to Sri Lanka, the first by Iranian president in 16 years. Fatima, what can you tell us about the significance and the importance of this trip?
Well, first of all, it is one of the lasting achievements of Iranian engineers in Sri Lanka. Yeah, today, this multi-purpose project was inaugurated by as you said, Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi. Iran has added yet another achievement to its list of successes. What is very unique about this project is that the process of designing, construction, and installation of the equipment was very, very unique. The objectives of this multi-purpose project were the irrigation of farmlands, supply of drinking water and industrial water to the area. Well, according to the studies that was done in that area, Sri Lanka was in need of this dam and the water to be distributed to the area, actually. So this project was very important for them and also for our Iranian engineers, because about 90% of the people who were working there, they were Iranians, and this is very important for us Iranians, and of course from an international aspect. Also, I'd like to talk to you about the detailed information of this project. I spoke to Mr. Mohammad Haydari, the CEO of Farab. Farab is one of the contractors of this huge project. Of course, before that, I should say that Iran won the competition between the European companies and Iran for designing this project. So it's very important for us that our engineers, especially engineers coming from Sharif University, were able to win this tender. He told me, Mr. Haydari, that this engineering project is one of a kind in the world, and it's unique and precise because the science and knowledge of the Iranian engineers helped overcome the very important obstacles, I would say, of this project. And of course, also I spoke to the head of the international section of the Ministry of Energy, Mr. Mojtaba Akbari, and he told me that the people in the country had requested them has requested Iran to help them in the mining industry, in the food industry, and engineering and technical products in power plants. So they want their country to move a step forward, and they are using the Iranian engineers and their knowledge and Iran's help to overcome these challenges and reach their goals.
Thank you, Fatima. Moving on, it's day 201 of the Israeli genocide in Gaza. The regime continues its massacre of civilians by pounding the blockaded territory with more airstrikes and artillery fire. In the latest attacks, three members of a family were killed and four wounded after an Israeli strike hit their home in the southern city of Rafah. Elsewhere, at the Nusayr refugee camp in central Gaza, which has been targeted relentlessly over the past few weeks, five people from one family were killed inside a home. Meanwhile, several Palestinians were also injured in the shelling of the towns of Beit Lahia, Beit Hanun, and Jabalia. Meanwhile, Palestinian civil defense forces have pulled out 51 more bodies from a mass grave recently discovered in the vicinity of Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis. Since the onset of the Israeli war in early October, nearly 34,200 Gazans have been killed, most of them women and children. Our correspondent Moti Abu Mosabe joined us earlier from the central Gaza city of Deir al-Balah to update us on the latest Israeli killing of civilians in the besieged coastal strip.
Yes, actually, the last night was horrific for all Palestinian civilians here in Gaza Strip, whereas the Israeli occupation forces intensified and ramped up the attacks against all areas of Gaza Strip. Here in the central area of Gaza Strip, the last attack actually claimed the lives of four Palestinian civilians after the Israeli warplanes carried out an airstrike against a group of the Palestinian civilians in Al-Nusayrat refugee camp. In the meantime, those attacks were intensified and continued against the northern part of Al-Nusayrat refugee camp. Ceaseless Israeli airstrikes hit those areas amid the continuous and the chronic artillery shelling that was maintained against Al-Mughraga neighborhood and Al-Zahra town, in addition to the northern part of Al-Nusayrat refugee camp. Here in Deir al-Balah city, the Israeli warplanes actually carried out another airstrike against a civilian car in the center of Deir al-Balah city. At least a Palestinian civilian was reportedly killed over the attack, in addition to multiple injuries. In the meantime, the Israeli artillery shelling was maintained against the eastern part of Deir al-Balah city. When it comes to Gaza city, the Israeli warplanes also scaled up their attacks against different neighborhoods inside Gaza city, including At-Tufah, Al-Shaja'iya, and Zaytun neighborhood. Those areas were under heavy bombardment. The northern part of the Gaza Strip, the current situation is still hyper-hazardous, as the Israeli occupation forces renewed their intense attacks against those areas, particularly Beit Lahia city. As you know, the Israeli occupation forces demanded the people who are still there to evacuate the entire city.
The news review, where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. The United States Senate has passed a $95 billion aid package for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan after its earlier approval by the House of Representatives. The bill now goes to the White House to be signed into law by President Joe Biden. It allocates more than $26 billion in military assistance to Israel, defying the international outcry against U.S. Military support for the regime amid the Gaza genocide. It does not include any funds for the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine refugees, which is the main source of assistance for Palestinians in Gaza. Rights groups and activists have time and again slammed Washington for its direct role in the Gaza genocide by arming the Israeli regime and vetoing ceasefire resolutions at the UN Security Council. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Mr. Harley Schlanger from the Schiller Institute, Germany, who's with us from Potsdam. Also, we have Director of the Center for Muslim Affairs, Mr. Jahangir Mohammed, who's joining us from Manchester. Let's start off with Mr. Schlanger in Potsdam. Sir, give us your perspective on this recent aid package that has been passed in probably the most questionable time possible right now, and it will be handing Israelis more arms to continue their genocide.
Well, it shows that when President Biden says he's talking to Netanyahu about not invading Rafah, about humanitarian support for the Palestinians, that he's lying. He's not telling the truth. This is, as you pointed out, in defiance of the rest of the world, which is insisting on a ceasefire, insisting on an end to Israeli occupation, a two-state solution. And it also is in defiance of a report of the United Nations, the Colonna report. The former French foreign minister issued a report on the UN relief organization, which the Israelis claim was involved in the attacks on October 7th. What she reported is that there's absolutely no evidence of this, that the Israelis presented no evidence, that they asked Israel for the evidence that there were members of UNRWA who were part of the terrorist operation, and they got nothing. So here you have a narrative of defense of Israel and its democratic rights, when in fact the U.S. is going to continue to provide arms, deadly lethal weapons, 2,000-pound bombs and the like, to the Israeli defense forces to carry out an ethnic cleansing of Palestine. And I should also add that at the same time they're providing $8 billion to Taiwan, supposedly to resist a Chinese attack, and another 60-plus billion to Ukraine. So this is an example of the United States funding wars, genocide, in defense of a collapsing unipolar order.
Mr. Jahangir Mohammed, this aid package, it allocates more than $26 billion in military assistance to Israel, and we're seeing it defying the international outcry against U.S. military support for the regime amid the Gaza genocide. To give us your perspective on what's taking place and the ramifications of this aid package.
Well, obviously, it's a reward for the State of Israel for carrying out genocide against the Palestinian people, and it will encourage them, and it will continue because it's designed to provide military and economic support. So it's shoring up the Israeli state on behalf of the U.S., which simply shows that this is not simply an Israeli project. This is a U.S. project designed to dispossess the Palestinian people, cleanse them, so Israel and the United States can occupy Gaza for whatever economic or political reasons that they have. And the fact that they have withdrawn UNRWA funding, are not providing humanitarian support, shows that they're just speaking with forked tongues, basically. On the one hand, pacifying or trying to pacify their local people or hoodwink them, which doesn't seem to be working. On the other hand, funding the genocide and the war and the Israeli military. So it's what we expect from the United States. This is what they do all the time, and it's the same in Ukraine and elsewhere. They provide funds for their military economic projects with the end goals in mind, which is to benefit the United States or the multinational corporations that run the United States in some way or other.
Thanks a lot, gentlemen. Harley Schlanger from the Schiller Institute Germany joining us from Potsdam, and also thanks to Director of Center for Muslim Affairs, Mr. Jahangir Mohammed, speaking to us from Manchester. The UK Parliament has passed legislation that allows the government to deport desperate asylum seekers to the East African country of Rwanda. The UK government claims the new law is aimed at deterring immigrants arriving on British shores on small boats from France. The Scottish National Party in the British legislature has branded the legislation as tantamount to state-sponsored people trafficking. Saeed Puraza reports from London.
Another overcrowded boat making the treacherous, sometimes deadly journey to southern England from French shores. Five, including a seven-year-old girl, didn't make it this time. Tens of thousands of asylum seekers have made these voyages over the last 2 years. The lives of many now hang in the balance as the British Parliament passes legislation that allows the government to deport irregular migrants to the East African country of Rwanda as they await their asylum applications to be processed.
My lords, Rwanda is a safe country that has proven time and again its ability to offer asylum seekers a safe haven and a chance to build a new life.
In recent years, a series of UK politicians have sought to deport asylum seekers here to Rwanda. Last year, the UK top court blocked the planned deportations as unlawful and risky. To circumvent the courts, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak suggested an updated law. Critics say his priority is to improve his flagging poll numbers.
It's an electoral ploy, and that's all it is. It's practically unworkable. It's morally disgraceful. It's simply the end of a desperate Tory government trying to whip up a racist tidal wave that it hopes will save it from the next general election defeat, which it won't.
Some polls conducted prior to the vote found 6 in 10 Britons, including conservative voters, thought the government should either accept some amendments to the Rwandan policy or scrap it altogether.
I think it's absolutely appalling. I don't see it's going to be a reasonable deterrent. People come here because they're desperate.
I think it's disgraceful. It's setting a terrible precedent and it's totally the wrong way to treat humans.
The controversial law is expected to come into force within days and the first deportation flights in weeks. UN rights experts have warned airlines and aviation regulators against participating in the deportations.
Now that the bill has cleared the parliamentary hurdles, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak can declare victory, at least on the legislative piece of the puzzle. But that is only the first step. Experts and critics say even if those Rwanda flights get in the air, the prospects of stopping or deterring boats from arriving on British shores through the English Channel are heavily contested. Saipur is up, London.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. all produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Tom Cotton, the bellicose U.S. senator from Arkansas, has voiced specific support for violence and inflicting pain on pro-Palestinian protesters. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, Tom Cotton, the bellicose U.S. senator from Arkansas, is not satisfied with pushing to employ the U.S. military against Black Lives Matter and Antifa protesters. He is now encouraging vigilance violence against Gaza genocide activists. Recently, he proposed throwing protesters in American cities off bridges. He urged people stuck in traffic related to Gaza genocide protest to take violent action. He said, I encourage people who get stuck behind the pro-Hamas mobs blocking traffic. Take matters into your own hands to get them out of the way. Protesters for Palestinian freedom are pro-Hamas mobs to Cotton, a man who invades against overtaxing but on the American tax day promotes bodily harm against those protesting U.S. tax money, fueling war crimes and genocide. Speaking to Fox News about protesters blocking traffic in demonstrations from California to Illinois to New York and elsewhere, Cotton said, if something like this happened in Arkansas on a bridge there, let's just say I think there would be a lot of very vet criminals that have been tossed overboard, not by law enforcement, but by the people whose road they are blocking, unquote. Then voicing specific support for violence and inflicting pain on protesters, Cotton asserted, if they glued their hands to a car or the pavement, well, probably pretty painful to have their skin ripped off. But I think that's the way we'd handle it in Arkansas. And I would encourage most people anywhere that get stuck behind criminals like this, who are trying to block traffic, to take matters in their own hands. Hatam Abu Daya, National Chair of the U.S. Palestinian Community Network, USPCN, told to the Electronic Intifada, it's really unbelievable in this day and age that a sitting U.S. senator can threaten violence to protesters and not be sanctioned or censured or anything else by his colleagues. It's been an incredible challenge in the past 6 months, especially, to experience what Palestinians have in the U.S., that our lives are expensive, that our rights aren't defended, that our very existence is threatened. But we can't and won't back down, and we will continue fighting to stop the genocide and make sure that racist, white, supremacist apologies for Israel like Tom Cotton will see a free Palestine in his lifetime. The American Civil Liberties Union did not respond to requests from the Electronic Intifada for First Amendment analysis on how much latitude Cotton has to encourage vigilance violence against protesters. Recently, Cotton also weighed in regarding a report that the International Criminal Court could bring international arrest warrants in the relatively near future against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and other top officials for war crimes. Cotton, attempting to intimidate the court and its officials, said he was putting ICC officials on notice. He added, "If you side with Hamas and Iran and enter the political battlefield against Israel, you will be sanctioned. Get your dollars out of the U.S. now and say goodbye to ever visiting America again," he said. He's clearly worried that a fair appraisal will find the child-killing regime of Israel has committed war crimes in Gaza and with U.S. arms. Meanwhile, the House of Representatives passed a resolution deeming the chant "From the River to the Sea, Palestine will be free" to be anti-Semitic. Just 43 Democrats voted against the resolution and one Republican. Unsurprisingly, many Democrats ended up on the side of noted anti-Semite and Islamophobe Marjorie Taylor Greene, a congressional QAnon enthusiast from the state of Georgia. The representatives aren't interested in addressing anti-Semitism with the resolution, but in restricting speech related to Palestinian freedom. Many supporters of the chant are strong supporters of equal rights for all those living between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea and oppose an apartheid regime of Israel, carrying out what the International Court of Justice has deemed a plausible genocide in Gaza. Most of the Palestinians in the coastal territory are there as a consequence of Zionist militias and the Zionist regime military dispossessing and displacing their grandparents and great-grandparents into Gaza in 1948. Many have family land that was stolen from them just a few miles away. The hypocrisy and wars of House members is clear. They had nothing to say about the Zionist regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's map presented in September 2023 at the United Nations, depicting all of the land between the river and the sea and the occupied Golan Heights as part of the fabricated regime of Israel. Yair Netanyahu, the Prime Minister's son, triumphantly claims on his Twitter, X, feed to his nearly 200,000 followers that from the river to the sea, this flag of Israel is all you will see. The apartheid vision of father and son is widely accepted or disregarded in the U.S. Congress. From co-sponsors of the River to the Sea resolution, Michael Lawler and Max Miller, on the far right to Jamie Raskin and Sheila Sharfless McCormick, who are supposedly on the left. Miller, of course, received no censure last year for his genocidal call to turn Gaza into a parking lot. Calls for equal rights for Palestinians are now hate speech to most members of the U.S. House of Representatives. University students and activists will pay a price, but such congressional foolishness is apt to lead to even more people questioning U.S. policies opposing Palestinian freedom. More unconditioned military aid to the Zionist regime, some $17 billion approved today by the U.S. House of Representatives, with just 58 members dissenting, will only make for more Israeli regime war crimes and with deeper U.S. complicity. Roughly $9 billion in humanitarian aid for areas devastated by war was approved, including an anticipated $2 billion for Palestinians in Gaza, The New York Times confuses very few when it says this military aid comes in the context of scores of Palestinian civilian casualties. In fact, the Zionist regime's military genocidal action with the backing of U.S. arms has resulted in tens of thousands of Palestinian civilian casualties since October 7th.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Day 200 of an unprecedented and horrendous war, the like of which has never been heard of. The genocidal war that has left 34,000 Palestinians dead, several thousand under rubble, presumed to be dead, 8,000 plus in detention. Infrastructure in ruins, hospitals either destroyed or turned into military bases, and Gazans being starved to death. And this while resistance fighters are still standing strong and even escalating attacks against IOF, both on the ground in Gaza and outside of the Gaza Strip. Now, Israel's failed to achieve any of its stated goals, despite all the complicity and unflinching support from its allies. Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Now, let's begin with our guest. We have Eve Engler, author and political analyst, activist in Montreal.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Good to have you with us, Eve. So what the Israeli regime has done in Gaza, and this is the 200th day, it's been really unprecedented, isn't it? You know, could you ever imagine all kinds of war crimes to be committed, and that with impunity, and ethnic cleansing of this proportion to get on the way?
Well, Israel has committed many crimes over the years, and of course, previous campaigns of slaughter in Gaza have been significant, but no, I personally have taken aback by just the scale of the violence, the scale of the destruction, the amount of time this has been continuing for. It's remarkable that they, you know, here we are almost 7 months into it, and you still have the U.S. giving ever more weapons. You still have governments like my government in Canada condemning protesters who are opposing this genocide rather than condemning the genocide. It's a slaughter in lifetimes of just unbelievable proportions.
Okay. Now, over the phone with us, we also have Ali Resk, political analyst in Beirut. Ali, it's nearly 7 months now, and Israel and its allies and accomplices, of course, have failed to achieve all the stated goals that they have cited in Gaza. Why?
Well, I think that, sorry, the line wasn't very clear, but I'll try to answer the question as much as possible. I think that 200 days Israel has been given the green light to basically do what it wants by its American ally. This is something I think which is beyond what we used to, even when it comes to American support for the Israeli side. But I think that one very important development which has taken place is the international sympathy which has emerged in support of the Palestinians, and also the anti-Israeli stance or the anti-Israeli protests which we see. As a matter of fact, what we're seeing in these days in particular in university, American universities, is very significant. So I think that while Israel was allowed to, you know, to do what it wants, to inflict as much pain as possible on the Palestinian side, I think that regardless, this has also exposed the Israelis more and more as being the evil party and has demonized Israel to a great level. So I think that Netanyahu and his American supporters haven't done Israel that much of a favor by allowing it to continue to commit these excesses for such a long period.
Right. Now, back to Montreal, the eve of today, more bodies of Palestinians and medical staff were found in mass graves at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis. Also, they found some in Shifa Hospital. 380, 40, more than 400 now. If this is not another proof to war crimes committed in Gaza, what is it?
I think it's in proof of more war crimes. It's proof of just the barbarity of what Israel has done. They deny everything. They've denied every everything over and over again. Mm-hmm. It's a level of criminality that's hard to wrap one's head around. And I have to say that the media in North America is largely ignoring the fact that the UN, obviously, all, you know, Palestinian officials are condemning this, are raising alarms about this. It's the first big attack against Al-Shifa back a couple weeks into Israel's slaughter campaign. There was, you know, big outcry, and there was denunciation, and Israel played all its games of denial of this and that. And now it's just become normalized that you people forget. I talk to people who are engaged on what's going on, and they think that this latest mass grave at the hospital is actually the one that just came out a week ago, and it gets all kind of like put together. But at some point, there will be a full assessment of what's actually happened. And I think all of the numbers that we're hearing of dead are actually much, much less than will be the final tally, because many people under the rubble, but also just the people who have died because of lack of food, lack of medical attention. You know, this is likely 100,000 people, upwards of 100,000 people that have been killed in, 200 days in a very small strip of land with not that many people. It's just unbelievable, and it's done with the open assistance of U.S., Canadian, German governments, arms. We still have these charities in Canada. You get subsidized donations to charities that are supporting the Israeli military. You have, you know, there's just so many ways in which our governments have enabled this. It really is a stunning thing. But as my co-panelist was pointing out, there's resistance. There's been here in Montreal, there's been demonstrations for 30 weeks, mass demonstrations, 30 weekends in a row. You have what's going on in the U.S. universities. You have hunger strike at McGill, maybe the most famous Canadian university. Students for now 60 days, two different students have been hospitalized because of the hunger strike. So you do have this resistance, but you have the open enabling assistance of the government and the leading politicians.
Right. Now, they, on Monday, the Israeli intelligence chief resigned over failing to prevent the Hamas October 7th attack. And he's the first Israeli official actually to take the rap for this massive military intelligence failure that Israel has admitted to. So tell us about the significance of this, and would you expect other Israeli officials to face the same fate?
I think that this might be followed by other resignations. This was a quite significant high-ranking resignation. You have the head of the Israeli military intelligence, a senior figure, and I think that we've seen a string of Israeli failures. It started, of course, with the October 7th Operation Al-Aqsa Storm, and I think that the Israelis also made a mistake when they, minimized the way Iran would retaliate to the attack which targeted the consulate in Damascus, which led to the death of a number of senior figures in the Iranian Revolutionary Guards. So there have been a string of failures, and I think that the intelligence brass, the Israeli intelligence brass, is quite angry, dismayed with the Israeli politicians who continue to set unrealistic goals. It'll be interesting to see if the fallout is going to target only military or intelligence officials, or will it extend to the political grass, which continue to pin the blame on others. But I believe that what we've seen with the resignation of the head of the Israeli military intelligence, I think that is, that will be the first, it's the first significant development in a string of expected developments which are expected to take place, because the failures that Israel has shown in this past period since October 7 are significant failures which I think are unprecedented in Israel's history.
All right, now, Eve, Israeli officials promised a while ago to, quote, flood Gaza with aid this month. But on the ground, when we talk to our reporters there, and we see another media, not much has changed in terms of humanitarian aid for a large and starving population in Gaza. UNRWA, also, you know what happened to UNRWA, and, you know, several Western countries, they stopped funding, so they were not able to continue with their mission that was getting help to the people in Gaza. So what can be done about this horrendous humanitarian situation?
It's scandalous that governments like the Canadian and U.S. government cut their funding to UNRWA based upon Israel's claims that, even if were true, wouldn't justify the measures that were taken. The Canadian government has at least gone back on their cuts, but most other countries haven't, and now we are here months later, a UN report, and there's the Israelis are not even willing to put forward their evidence that they made the claim. So this is you know, in total direct contrast or in contradiction to what the International Court of Justice, when they said there was a plausible genocide, they said that in their provisional rulings that there needed to be assistance, basic assistance, humanitarian assistance, enter Gaza. And then they repeated that about, I guess, about a month ago. And yet you have the Israelis, you know, blowing up aid workers, and they actually blew up a Canadian aid truck only 10 days ago after, you know, killing seven international aid workers a few weeks ago. And so you know, what has to happen here? What has to happen is that this is nothing rocket science, right? This goes to the heart of the whole what Israel's done in Gaza now for 20 some odd years, which is, why does Israel get to decide what goes in and out? The siege. And fortunately, there's a big the Freedom Flotilla, where there's a bunch of boats, international solidarity mission to try to break Israel's siege. And this you know, siege, which has been going on for two decades, that Israel clamping down on it and, you know, making it, basically trying to starve the population. This is, it's an outrage. You know, Palestinians should have the access to their airspace, should have access to their you know, seaway. They should have access, of course, to the land borders. But this is Israel's control. And you know, what can be done is there needs to be, you know, more pressure to allow products into Israel that not, or into Gaza, that Israel can't just, you know, wantonly decide this or that is outside of bounds. And this is just a total violation, of the World Court's provisional rulings, and yet, you know, ho-hum, everything just continues on with the most modest of challenges to Israeli starvation policy.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, now let me turn to Ali Ruzki in Beirut. Ali, you know, nearly 7 months passing, but resistance fighters, be it inside Gaza or outside, those in Yemen, Iraq, and Lebanon, they have been standing strong, and even they've escalated their attacks. Like recently, Hezbollah waging this deepest attack in months since the Gaza genocide started, deep inside the Israeli-occupied territories. And, of course, they had issued warnings. They had also drawn red lines that the occupation forces crossed. And then they started hitting civilians inside Lebanon. So let's have your take on Hezbollah's performance and retaliatory attacks.
Well, Hezbollah, from day one, has stated that its military operation, the first military operation it launched on November 8th, was in support of the Gazans, of the Palestinian resistance fighters. I think that that stance stems both from ideological and also from some pragmatic reasons. Ideologically speaking, Hezbollah has always stated that it supports any form of anti-Israeli resistance. Pragmatically speaking, also, this was something which was linked to Lebanese national security, as Hezbollah's leader, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, said on more than one occasion, saying that if the Israelis are victorious against Hamas, if they are victorious in Gaza, then they'll turn their eyes towards Lebanon. Lebanon will become the next target. Indeed, before Operation Al-Aqsa Storm, Israeli officials had focused a lot of their statements on the Lebanese front, on Hezbollah. So, as I said, there are various considerations behind Hezbollah's military action, both ideological and pragmatic, and I think that Hezbollah has done quite well in preserving a certain level of deterrence whilst not giving Israel an excuse to launch an all-out war against Lebanon. And this has been, these have been Hezbollah's twin goals, if you would like. Preserving deterrence whilst preventing all-out war, which would be devastating for both the Israeli and for the Lebanese sides. And as I was saying, Hezbollah has played this game successfully to a large degree. It has inflicted losses, it has preserved deterrence. And Israel, yes, it has launched attacks deeper into Lebanese territory, that has to be said, but it still has dared to ignite an all-out war, which many have been warning of.
Okay, Eva, one last question. We don't have much time. More than a million civilians, as you know, including some 600,000 children, are in the direct line of fire in Rafah. And this is while the Israeli regime is saying that they insist that we are going to go ahead with that invasion. And, you know, everybody is warning Israel against this planned invasion. Even the U.S., as closest ally, complicit in the genocide. State Department saying there is no way to safely evacuate all those Palestinians from Rafah. So what's going to become of Rafah?
Well, unfortunately, I think there's a very good chance that Israel is going to go in a hard way in Rafah. Obviously, they've already been bombing kind of periodically. I think it is possible, though, as the reports suggested, that the U.S. put pressure to not have a bigger Israeli response towards Iran, and that the exchange for that was to the U.S. give more support for Israel's attacks on Rafah. It's a matter of I think if the protests in the U.S. universities, if they keep escalating in the next few days, if the protests around the world keep escalating, I think that contributes somewhat to restraining the violence. But it's a matter of course, just people saying no and doing what we can to oppose our government's complicity. And obviously, the more Israelis, unfortunately, Israelis haven't been protesting enough. There are small movement within Israel, and that movement, of course, also needs to be to build. But popular global condemnation is the only thing we really have here.
Okay. Okay, appreciate your contribution and comments. Adi Resk, public analyst in Beirut, Yves Engler, author and political activist in Montreal, Canada.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Al-Naqi means the pure, the immaculate, the clean. Al-Hadi means the guide. All the Imams came for guidance.
As-salamu alaykum ya ahla bayt al-nubuwa wa mawdha' al-risala wa mukhtalaf al-malaik.
Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety, This is Dialogue, an introduction into the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam was the pure direct descendant of the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. He was the 10th divinely appointed successor. He was the 10th divinely appointed imam. He was the 10th divinely appointed trustee to the final Messenger of Allah, the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. A great number of Muslims believed in the imama of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, and they found it obligatory upon them to follow and obey Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam. A vast amount of legal dues and monies that must be given to the imam were carried to Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, as he was the financial epicenter of the Shia. And it was partly due to this financial leadership of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam that governmental investigators and policemen reported in detail to the Abbasid Caliph al-Mutawakkil. And so al-Mutawakkil Abbasi was the most bitter enemy of not only the Alawis and the followers of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, but he was a bitter enemy of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam himself. At this moment, we invite you to listen to parts of the Arabic text of Ziyarat Jamiatul Kabira by Imam Hadi alayhi salam, along with its English translation. Please stay tuned.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu ala a'immatil huda wa masabihit tuja wa a'lamit tuqa wa dawin nuha.
In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety, the owners of understanding, the endued with thoughts, the havens of the peoples, the inheritors of the prophets, the perfect specimen, the most excellent call in the arguments of Allah against the inhabitants of the world, the hereafter and the former world. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon you all.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Welcome back. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam. There's this one dialogue that Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam has with one of his companions from Ahwaz. Now, this very complex theological, perhaps even philosophical matter comes up, and is something that hopefully we're going to try to cover on the program, even though we don't have a lot of time. Now, this is also a kind of a question that many of us ask, even in the present day. And so the question was, does Allah not know what the people will do so that Allah has to try them? Right? So here, the fundamental thing is that we are saying, if Allah knows what the people will do, then why does Allah put them into trials in order for those people to prove themselves? If he already knows, why doesn't he just send them to heaven or hell based upon his knowledge of what these individuals are going to do? So Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, he says, yes, Allah knows what these individuals shall do even before what they do. And so here, you know, we kind of think, well, perhaps this is jabr. This is this compulsion, absolute compulsion. But in reality, what's happening is that because Allah the Almighty, in His
you know, all knowledge and all wisdom and all hearing and all knowing, past, present, and future, right? He knows what an individual will do out of their own free will. So Allah knows, for example, what I will do in my life based upon my voluntary and free will choices. It really is a mind-boggling concept, because my free will is something that I, as a, you know, semi-independent existent being, will do